Chapter 30. An escape from immediate preoccupations, a flight to the life they always dreamed of living. Once or twice, now that this new life had actually drawn its magic circle about them, S.E. had asked herself if S.E. had done right, but hitherto such conjectures had been no more than the retrospective excursions of an active fancy. Now, for the first time, it startled her a little to find how little she knew of the material foundation on which her happiness was built. She glanced again at her husband, and was reassured by the composure of his face, yet she felt the need of more definite grounds for her reassurance. "But doesn't this suit worry you? Why have you never spoken to me about it?" He answered both questions at once. "I didn't speak of it at first, because it did worry me, annoyed me, rather. But it's all ancient history now. Your correspondent must have got hold of a back number of the Sentinel." Apostrophe, she felt a quick thrill of relief. "Why, you mean it's over? He's lost his case?" There was a just perceptible delay in Boyne's reply. "The suit's been withdrawn, that's all." But she persisted, as if to exonerate herself from the inward charge of being too easily put off. "W withdrawn because he saw he had no chance?" "Oh, he had no chance," Boyne answered. She was still struggling with a dimly felt perplexity at the back of her thoughts. How long ago was it withdrawn? He paused, as if with a slight return of his former uncertainty. "I've just had the news now, but I've been expecting it." "Just now in one of your letters?" "Yes, in one of my letters." She made no answer, and was aware only, after a short interval of waiting, that he had risen, and strolling across the room, had placed himself on the sofa at her side. She felt him, as he did so, pass an arm about her. She felt his hand seek hers and clasp it, and turning slowly, drawn by the warmth of his cheek, she met the smiling clearness of his eyes. "It's all right, it's all right," she questioned, through the flood of her dissolving doubts. "And, give you my word, it never was righter," he laughed back at her, holding her close. 3. One of the strangest things she was afterward to recall out of all the next day's incredible strangeness was the sudden and complete recovery of her sense of security. It was in the air, when she woke in her low-ceilinged, dusky room. It accompanied her downstairs to the breakfast table, flashed out at her from the fire, and reduplicated itself brightly from the flanks of the urn and the sturdy flutings of the Georgian teapot. It was as if, in some roundabout way, all her diffused apprehensions of the previous day, with their moment of sharp concentration about the newspaper article, as if this dim questioning of the future, and startled return upon the past, had between them liquidated the arrears of some haunting moral obligation. If S.E. had indeed been careless of her husband's affairs, it was, her new state seemed to prove, because her faith in him instinctively justified such carelessness, and his right to her faith had overwhelmingly affirmed itself in the very face of menace and suspicion. S.E. had never seen him more untroubled, more naturally and unconsciously in possession of himself, than after the cross-examination to which S.E. had subjected him. It was almost as if he had been aware of her lurking doubts, and had wanted the air cleared as much as she did. It was as clear, thank heaven, as the bright outer light that surprised her almost with a touch of summer when she issued from the house for her daily round of the gardens. As he had left Boyne at his desk, indulging herself, as she passed the library door, by a last peep at his quiet face, where he bent, pipe in his mouth, above his papers, and now as he had her own morning's task to perform. The task involved on such charmed winter days almost as much delighted loitering about the different quarters of her demesne, as if spring were already at work on shrubs and borders. There were such inexhaustible possibilities still before her, such opportunities to bring out the latent graces of the old place, without a single irreverent touch of alteration, that the winter months were all too short to plan what spring and autumn executed. And her recovered sense of safety gave, On this particular morning, a peculiar zest to her progress through the sweet, still place. She went first to the kitchen garden, where the espaliered pear trees drew complicated patterns on the walls, and pigeons were fluttering and preening about the silvery slated roof of their cot. There was something wrong about the piping of the hothouse, and she was expecting an authority from Dorchester, who was to drive out between trains and make a diagnosis of the boiler. But when she dipped into the damp heat of the greenhouses, among the spiced scents and waxy pinks and reds of old-fashioned exotics, even the flora of Ling was in the note, she learned that the great man had not arrived, and the day being too rare to waste in an artificial atmosphere, she came out again, and paced slowly along the springy turf of the bowling green to the gardens behind the house. At their farther end rose a grass terrace, commanding, over the fish pond and the yew hedges, a view of the long house front, with its twisted chimney stacks and the blue shadows of its roof angles, all drenched in the pale gold moisture of the air. Seen thus, across the level tracery of the yews, under the suffused, mild light, it sent her, from its open windows and hospitably smoking chimneys, the look of some warm human presence, of a mind slowly ripened on a sunny wall of experience. As he had never before had so deep a sense of her intimacy with it, such a conviction, that its secrets were all beneficent, kept, as they said to children, for one's good, so complete a trust in its power, to gather up her life and nets into the harmonious pattern of the long, long story it sat there weaving in the sun. She heard steps behind her, and turned, expecting to see the gardener, accompanied by the engineer from Dorchester. But only one figure was in sight, that of a youngish, slightly built man, who, for reasons she could not on the spot have specified, did not remotely resemble her preconceived notion of an authority on hothouse boilers. The newcomer, on seeing her, lifted his hat, and paused with the air of a gentleman, perhaps a traveler desirous of having it immediately known that his intrusion is involuntary. The local fame of Ling occasionally attracted the more intelligent sightseer, and Mary half expected to see the stranger dissemble a camera, or justify his presence by producing it. But he made no gesture of any sort, and after a moment she asked, in a tone responding to the courteous deprecation of his attitude, "Is there anyone you wish to see?" "I came to see Mr. Boyne," he replied. His intonation, rather than his accent, was faintly American, and Mary, at the familiar note, looked at him more closely. The brim of his soft felt hat cast a shade on his face, which, thus obscured, wore to her short-sighted gaze a look of seriousness, as of a person arriving en business, uncivilly but firmly aware of his rights. Past experience had made Mary equally sensible to such claims, but she was jealous of her husband's morning hours, and doubtful of his having given anyone the right to intrude on them. "Have you an appointment with Mr. Boyne?" she asked. He hesitated, as if unprepared for the question. "Not exactly an appointment," he replied. "Then I'm afraid, this being his working time, that he can't receive you now. Will you give me a message, or come back later?" The visitor, again lifting his hat, briefly replied that he would come back later, and walked away, as if to regain the front of the house. As his figure receded down the walk between the yew hedges, Mary saw him pause and look up an instant at the peaceful house front bathed in faint winter sunshine, and it struck her, with a tardy touch of compunction, that it would have been more humane to ask if he had come from a distance, and to offer, in that case, to inquire if her husband could receive him. But as the thought occurred to her, he passed out of sight behind a pyramidal yew, and at the same moment her attention was distracted by the approach of the gardener, attended by the bearded pepper and salt figure of the boilermaker from Dorchester. The encounter with this authority led to such far-reaching issues that they resulted in his finding it expedient to ignore his train, and beguiled Mary into spending the remainder of the morning in absorbed confabulation among the greenhouses. She was startled to find, When the colloquy ended, that it was nearly luncheon time, and she half expected, as she hurried back to the house, to see her husband coming out to meet her. But she found no one in the court, but an undergardener raking the gravel, and the hall, when she entered it, was so silent that she guessed Boyne to be still at work behind the closed door of the library. Not wishing to disturb him, she turned into the drawing room, and there, at a writing table, lost herself in renewed calculations of the outlay to which the morning's conference had committed her. The knowledge that she could permit herself such follies had not yet lost its novelty, and somehow, in contrast to the vague apprehensions of the previous days, it now seemed an element of her recovered security, of the sense that, as Ned had said, things in general had never been either. She was still luxuriating in a lavish play of figures when the parlor maid, from the threshold, roused her with a dubiously worded inquiry as to the expediency of serving luncheon. It was one of their jokes that Trimble announced luncheon as if she were divulging a state secret, and Mary, intent upon her papers, merely murmured an absent-minded assent. She felt Trimble wavering expressively on the threshold, as if in rebuke of such offhand acquiescence. Then her retreating steps sounded down the passage, and Mary, pushing away her papers, crossed the hall and went to the library door. It was still closed, and she wavered in her turn, disliking to disturb her husband, yet anxious that he should not exceed his normal measure of work. As she stood there, balancing her impulses, the esoteric Trimble returned with the announcement of luncheon, and Mary, thus impelled, opened the door and went into the library. Boyne was not at his desk, and she peered about her, expecting to discover him at the bookshelves, somewhere down the length of the room. But her call brought no response, and gradually it became clear to her that he was not in the library. She turned back to the parlor maid. "Mr. Boyne must be upstairs. Please tell him that luncheon is ready." The parlor maid appeared to hesitate between the obvious duty of obeying orders and an equally obvious conviction of the foolishness of the injunction laid upon her. The struggle resulted in her saying doubtfully, "If you please, madam, Mr. Boyne's not upstairs." "Not in his room? Are you sure?" "I'm sure, madam." Mary consulted the clock. "Where is he, then?" "He's gone out," Trimble announced, with the superior air of one who has respectfully waited for the question that a well-ordered mind would have first propounded. Mary's previous conjecture had been right, then. Boyne must have gone to the gardens to meet her, and since as he had missed him, it was clear that he had taken the shorter way by the south door, instead of going round to the court. She crossed the hall to the glass portal opening directly on the yew garden, but the parlor maid, after another moment of inner conflict, decided to bring out recklessly, "Please, madam, Mr. Boyne didn't go that way." Mary turned back. "Where did he go? And when?" "He went out of the front door, up the drive, madam." It was a matter of principle with Trimble never to answer more than one question at a time. "Up the drive? At this hour?" Mary went to the door herself, and glanced across the court through the long tunnel of bare limes. But its perspective was as empty as when he had scanned it on entering the house. "Did Mr. Boyne leave no message?" she asked. Trimble seemed to surrender herself to a last struggle with the forces of chaos. "No, madam. He just went out with the gentleman." "The gentleman? What gentleman?" Mary wheeled about, as if to front this new factor. "The gentleman who called, madam," said Trimble, resignedly. "When did a gentleman call? Do explain yourself, Trimble." Only the fact that Mary was very hungry, and that she wanted to consult her husband about the greenhouses, would have caused her to lay so unusual an injunction on her attendant, and even now she was detached enough to note in Trimble's eye the dawning defiance of the respectful subordinate who has been pressed too hard. I couldn't exactly say the hour, madam, because I didn't let the gentleman in, she replied, with the air of magnanimously ignoring the irregularity of her mistress's course. You didn't let him in? No, madam. When the bell rang I was dressing, and Agnes, go and ask Agnes, then, Mary interjected. Trimble still wore her look of patient magnanimity. Agnes would not know, madam, for she had unfortunately burnt her hand in trying the wick of the new lamp from town. Trimble, as Mary was aware, had always been opposed to the new lamp, and so Mrs. Duckett sent the kitchen maid instead. Mary looked again at the clock. It's after two. Go and ask the kitchen maid if Mr. Boyne left any word. She went into luncheon without waiting, and Trimble presently brought her there the kitchen maid's statement, that the gentleman had called about 1 o'clock, that Mr. Boyne had gone out with him without leaving any message. The kitchen maid did not even know the caller's name, for he had written it on a slip of paper, which he... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.